This podcast is brought to you by Joy sponsor Pam Ann.
Hello, Melbourne. It's Pam Ann here. I'm so excited. I'm going to be touching down at the Comedy Theatre in August. See you soon. I love you, Melbourne. Mwah.
Set to land in Melbourne this August for two hilarious shows, Friday, August 24 and Saturday, August 25. Get your tickets now at ticketmaster.com.au.
Welcome to The Informer, Joy 94.9's nightly news and current affairs program, and your link to the stories that matter. We are committed to bringing you the day's most important news and current affairs stories from an LGBTI perspective. If it matters to the LGBTI community, we will cover it. We want to hear from you. Join the conversation, SMS 0427 Joy 949 or email onair at joy.org.au or follow us on Twitter at The Informer Joy.
It's Tuesday, the 27th of March. Welcome to your nightly news and current affairs show, The Informer. I'm your host, Dylan Joel. Tonight on the show, we pop by the Australian Bureau of Statistics and have a chat after they released an analytical article today highlighting the population characteristics of 1,260 people who gave an intentional and valid sex and/or gender-diverse response in the 2016 census. We continue our conversation with Misty Farquhar from Perth, who is doing a PhD study on living outside the binary in Australia, fence sitter or bridge climber, as we continue to explore the realities of visually and understanding our bisexual community as a part of Bisexual Health Awareness Month. And we discuss consent education at universities as we talk to the team from YEAR. Campus-based sexual harassment and assault is a huge issue across Australian universities, and they are helping young people navigate healthy sexual relationships with a focus on affirmative consent. We find out how.
This is The Informer, Joy's nightly news and current affairs program. We want to hear from you. Join the conversation, SMS us on 0427 Joy 949, email onair at joy.org.au or add us on Twitter at The Informer Joy.
In 2016, the census of population and housing took an important step towards collecting Australian statistics on sex and gender diversity, as they made it possible for all Australians to report their sex in a way that was not limited to either male or female. And today, the Australian Bureau of Statistics released their findings in an analytical article highlighting the population characteristics of the 1,260 people who gave an intentional and valid sex and or gender diverse response in the 2016 census. Dean R. Curie spoke to Philip Wise, the Director of Census Dissemination from the ABS, about what the data can tell us about these parts of our communities.
One of the aims of the 2016 census was to make it possible for all Australians to report their sex in a way not limited to male or female. And this was following on from the Australian Attorney General's Department guidelines on the recognition of sex and gender, which were updated from memory around 2015. And that required Australian government departments and agencies to progressively align their existing and future business practices with the guidelines, which were to enable reporting of sex and gender not limited to male or female.
So that's why in the 2016 census, if you identified as something other than male or female, you were able to list what that meant on the form. But how is this done?
So the ABS for the census essentially implemented a few special procedures that enabled people to describe in free text what they felt best described their association with the concepts of sex and gender. So we didn't actually have a classification that we gave to people or a tick box list. We just allowed them to write what they felt most comfortable describing themselves as.
Of the 1,260 people who listed themselves as something other than male or female, 40 people said they were intersex or indeterminate, 70 identified as trans males, 100 identified as trans females, 170 identified as transgender, not elsewhere classified, 220 identified as non-binary, 230 identified as another gender, and 440 identified as other, not further defined. This is a good start. But these numbers aren't an accurate representation of all people in Australia who don't identify as male or female. The ABS acknowledged that there was a variety of responses to the sex question given on the census form, which were grouped into categories which we'll explore now in this interview. And these give an indication of the diversity of sex and or gender diverse responses to these questions.
So essentially what we did with the 2016 census was take one step on a journey to getting an accurate representative estimate of the number of people who are neither male nor female in Australia. Some of the challenges that we faced that led us to conclude that that 1,260 count was inaccurate related to some of the steps that people had to go through in order to get a form that enabled them to respond as neither male nor female. So, for example, when we run the census, sometimes it's just one person in the household who will fill in the form for everyone in that household, and they might not understand how people would like to respond to the sex and gender question. That segues into another limitation of the form. We only have one question on the sex of a person, so we can't actually tease out some of these sex and gender concepts that would enable us to arrive at a more accurate representation of people's identity. Another aspect was obviously the online form outage that happened with the 2016 census. So that placed an enormous strain on the phone lines that were our primary source of, I guess, we directed people to call up the phone line so they could request a special form to enable them to respond as neither male nor female. And obviously with the strain on the phone system, not everyone who wanted to could get through and get access to a form. We also ran a pilot test that we cover in one of the articles online to test wider perceptions in the public of having a third option to the sex and gender question, which is other and a free text entry box. Some of the findings from that analysis on that pilot test indicate that we didn't get any significant difference to non-response or vandalism for that question, so that's very encouraging.
Remember, this was 2016, which was before the postal survey, and people had much more public conversations in their living rooms about sex, sexuality and gender in 2017. So is expanding on this something that the ABS want to do for the 2021 census so we can get a clearer picture?
We haven't reached that decision yet because we're still working through what the form will look like and how we will implement an online form and all those sort of options. So we're certainly looking to take the learnings from the 2016 experience as it relates to the instructions we provided to people in order to respond as neither male nor female, as well as the design of the form. And we'll finalise how we're going to capture the data in another, I think it's about 2 years' time. But it is a good point that you raise because we're just opening up the consultation on the content for the 2021 census, so the questions that we ask, and we're inviting the public to make submissions, I think from April through to June this year. So keep an eye on the ABS website if you'd like to get involved in that process. We certainly would welcome community views on how we can best collect information such as this.
And that is something we're certainly going to be letting you all know about here on The Informer when that happens. But now let's dive into the data and see what that had to say, starting with the ages of people who identified as sex or gender diverse and where they were living.
So the median age of people who identified as sex and or gender diverse was 30 years compared to the rest of the Australian population, which was 38 years. There are a couple of interesting things about where sex and or gender diverse people live. So a third of people who identified as sex and or gender diverse lived in Victoria. This was followed by 26% in New South Wales and 18% in Queensland. Less than 1% of this group lived in the Northern Territory. But we also know, I mean, census, we have a lot of rich, detailed information about where people live, also where they lived 1 and 5 years ago. And we know that people who identified as sex and or gender diverse were twice as likely than the rest of the Australian population to have changed their place of usual residence in the year prior to the census.
People who identified as sex and or gender diverse were most likely to live in a rented dwelling, at almost twice the proportion of the rest of the Australian population. This was the most common living arrangement across all age groups for sex and or gender diverse people, with the exception of those aged 65 years and over who were more likely to own their own dwelling outright. Why was whether we own our own house or not something the census even wanted to know?
Essentially, we have this population data and we decided to explore some of the headline census data topics for the sex and or gender diverse population, and housing tenure was a significant area of interest in the reporting on the data releases last year, so we thought we would explore that in closer detail, and that led to some interesting findings. A fifth of sex and or gender diverse population that we collected in the 2016 census lived alone, which is significantly higher than the rest of the Australian population, which was 10%. And then a further fifth of the sex and or gender diverse population lived in a group household. 63% of the sex and or gender diverse population had no religion, which that's more than twice the 30% for the Australian population overall. You can also see that follows logically that the rate of Christian religious affiliation for the sex and gender diverse population is roughly one third that of the rest of the Australian population. So 16% to 52%. Quite significantly different.
The sex and or gender diverse group were more likely than the rest of the Australian population to not have a religious affiliation across all age groups. The difference was most noticeable in young adults who were aged 18 to 34, where almost three quarters of the sex and or gender diverse people reported not having a religious affiliation, compared with 39% of the rest of the population in this age group. Considering how much religion is often used as a tool against members of our communities, this data might actually be helpful to the Ruddock Review on Religious Protections. When it comes to data on how members of our communities are employed or how much they earn, this is where the numbers get really interesting.
When I look at census data, I think, you know, educational outcomes and occupation outcomes. So for the sex and gender diverse population, we actually found that they're more likely to have completed a bachelor degree or above in terms of educational attainment compared to the rest of the Australian population. So 37% of sex and gender diverse people have a bachelor degree or higher, compared with 24%. But as you transition through to the workforce, what you're seeing, as was described, is that 65% of sex and gender diverse people were in the labour force, which is right in the middle of the male and female split, 70 and 60%. 55% of sex and gender diverse population were employed, which is less than the rate for males overall, which was 65%, but a similar proportion to females at 56%. So strong educational attainment, but slightly less participation in the labour force than the male population in Australia, and similar rates to the labour force participation for females. What I really like about census data is it's not just the occupation, it's also social information. And that's a real strength in some of the results that we're seeing for the sex and gender diverse population, where they're twice as likely as the rest of the Australian population to have done voluntary work in the year prior to the census, 42% compared with 21%. And close to half of the 15 to 34-year-old sex and gender diverse population had volunteered in that time, which is a really strong, I think, indicator of engagement in local communities. Shows the strength of your participation in society when you have high levels of volunteering. Overall, in the sex and gender diverse group, the most common occupational group was professionals. So 35% of sex and gender diverse people were professionals. It's much more than the Australian population overall, 23%. And then when we break down the next most common occupations, we're looking at community and personal service workers, clerical and administrative workers, managers and sales workers.
If you look at the combination of volunteer work participation and the types of paid work undertaken, there seems to be a trend towards working within the community and helping others. With there being a greater need for support services in our community or finding a place to be, these figures aren't really that surprising for us. And it'll be interesting to see if these numbers increase after the postal survey in regards to the needs of other areas in our communities. So now that we know this data, what's the next step? How can we increase the number of participants to truly reflect the diverse gender and sexuality communities of Australia? What is it that we need to improve?
I think we missed a lot of people who would help give us a more accurate picture of some of the population characteristics for sex and gender diverse people. On a personal level, I think there's a lot of fantastic information on the ABS website about the data that we collected in the 2016 census. So while it's not an accurate measure of all sex and gender diverse people in Australia, it does give us a lot of fascinating insights into some of their population characteristics. And we very much appreciate the support from the sex and gender diverse community in helping us improve our approach to collecting the data.
That was Philip Wise, the Director of Census Dissemination from the Australian Bureau of Statistics, talking about today's data released highlighting the population characteristics of the 1,260 people who gave an intentional and valid sex and or gender diverse response in the 2016 census.
There is still more to come on Joy's The Informer, the news program from an LGBTI perspective.
Founded in 2005, Yare has built Australia's largest ever online and face-to-face engagement connecting young people with sexual health information and supporting young people to take control of their sexual health through participation and leadership. And they join us tonight to talk consent. Campus-based sexual harassment and assault is a huge issue across Australian universities, especially during orientation week, where incidents of assault see a significant spike. Yare help people who are young navigate healthy sexual relationships with a focus on affirmative consent. But how do they do that? With selected universities addressing the issue by rolling out sexual consent courses and initiating the Respect Now Always campaign. We spoke to Yare's peer educators, Cassie and Chris, about what it means to educate people on consent and how it is improving communication about being safe and respectful during sex.
I didn't really get a good sex education, so I like that I get the opportunity to go and talk to young people and expand their knowledge on sexual health and consent and that sort of thing.
When going into universities and stuff, there's a few different kind of topics and areas that we cover, kind of looking at STIs, safer sexual practice, healthy relationships, and then consent as well.
Cassie and Chris are peer educators with Yare, Youth Empowered Around Health. They've gone into universities and spoken to students about consent and what to be aware of so that you can have sex in a safe and respectful way where both parties can enjoy themselves. The reality is that sexual assault happens and we need to have these conversations not only with victims but with perpetrators.
Yes, it's very, especially the sort of climate that universities have where there's a big culture of drinking and going out and partying with everyone else and that sort of thing, and people don't even have a basic understanding of how consent works, and it's obviously that's causing issues. But it's sort of something that you expect people at that, who have gotten into university to be able to understand that, and lots of them don't yet.
Instead of peer-based programs where young people speak to other young people, some universities have engaged a website to inform students about consent, something that Chris and Cassie feel doesn't do a good enough job when it comes to the realities of what sexual consent actually means.
I think it's because of everything with O Week and that sort of thing, where people are drinking a lot more than they normally would, and they're not sort of thinking about the consequences of their actions, I guess. And so consent education is kind of important so that we can be like, hey, you do actually need to ask people for consent for these sort of things. It's, the rules aren't different just because everyone's drunk.
Well, you're coming from both a place of understanding and experience that they can relate to a bit more. So in terms of what a lot of the universities are doing now with an online program on consent, it's not that easy to relate or to kind of engage with something that you're required to do online. There's no one there kind of talking you through this. There's no one there that you're responding to. And it just ends up being a little bit like got to do this. And you just power through it and select what you know to be the right answers, but don't really actually have an opportunity to apply that thought to it that you can when you've got another person in the room asking you these questions.
But it's a start, but we also have, online modules on plagiarism, and I know for a fact that people don't read that. They go through, they click the right answers, and then they'll never look at it again. And I think it's also not personal enough for the kind of conversation either. So I think especially with discussions of consent, you need to be able to put faces to it. Otherwise, people are going to ignore the main message. So I guess I think that it needs to be a workshop. It needs to be in person. Otherwise, people are going to skip through it and they're not going to get the information that they need out of it.
So how exactly do the team at Yare educate people about consent?
We run workshops workshops. So what happens is we're at peer leds. We train up, you know, other young people, and then we go out to schools and universities, and we try and be as interactive as possible and run workshops around the issues of consent. So we do different activities and sort of get people to talk about what consent and sexual health is for them, and then sort of give them a little bit more information. So basically what we do is we've got a bunch of sort of scenarios, or even just reactions that people might have in a sexual situation, or it could really be applied to any situation, but we use it as a sexual context. And we do sort of a traffic light thing. So the green is definitely consenting. The orange is needs more discussion, and the red is definitely not consenting. And basically there'll be little cards with the partner says to keep going, or, you know, partner suddenly went stiff. And it's sort of like it goes through not just the verbal cues that people might give to signify consent, but also the non-verbal things that you need to look out for as well, just to get people to think about how we do show whether we're consenting to an activity or not.
We asked if this was something that was compulsory at universities. After all, unis are full of students from different backgrounds, different faiths, even different countries. So getting communication like this across the board is pretty important, and this sounds like a good way to do it.
At universities that opt in, we haven't run any that were compulsory. At schools, it's a bit different because they are all sitting in the same classroom, so it is compulsory for them. But for universities, yeah, we've never had a session that people had to come to. It's all voluntary. And the problem with that is a lot of the people that we get to come in are the people who do actually already know the stuff. So it's good because you get to talk to people who are like-minded, but we're not getting the message that we need to get across to the people who actually need it.
What is really good about YES training is that it isn't just about educating the victims to say stop or no, but it's also about educating others to recognise what consent may mean when looking at their partner's body language. After all, it does take two to tango, and both of these parties are responsible for each other's safety and protection.
I think that you can say, you know, people need to make their consent clearer, but you know, there's situations where it might be difficult for a person to say no, or it might be they might feel like they have to say yes, and it should be up to the person who is giving their full consent to be able to recognise that the other person isn't as into it as them, so that there isn't a situation where someone feels forced into something they're not comfortable with.
Yeah, it's very much about engaging people in that conversation around how to engage in their partner's consent, or the person that they're having sex with consent, or the people they're having sex with consent. It's all about kind of helping them become more aware of those cues and helping them discuss with their partner about whether they're feeling uncomfortable or whether they want to stop, rather than kind of focusing on their own ability to talk about it. But then we also do encourage people to learn to speak up about their concerns as well.
Other than this, how can we improve conversations about consent at universities?
I think greater engagement with the colleges is one of the number one things that needs to occur. So in terms of colleges do have a bit of a reputation around kind of misconduct in these areas. And along with that, also having the student clubs engage and having all of the leadership of student clubs engaged in kind of education around these areas. A lot of the universities in Melbourne, I know for the clubs and societies, they're required to have grievance officers at events, and making sure that they're trained up in kind of recognising situations where someone might be in an unsafe situation, and helping people identify and understand within the leadership structures what these means, and having that kind of across-the-board understanding within those leadership structures could really help bring it further down throughout the students that they're engaging with as well, which does end up being quite a large body of students, especially with clubs and societies.
That was Cassie and Chris, peer educators from YEAR, Youth and Empowerment Around Health. And if you would like to know more about their consent courses, head to yeah.org.au or check them out via our social media.
This is The Informer, Joy 94.9's nightly news and current affairs program, and your link to the stories that matter.
Bisexual Health Awareness Month was launched on social media 5 years ago in March and is happening right now, providing a space for greater conversation, understanding, and for raising greater awareness about the bisexual community. People in the bisexual community face all the same challenges as lesbians and gay people, but are also subject to erasure and invalidation and suffer poorer physical and mental health. So how can we change that? Last night, Dean Arcuri spoke with Misty Fakua about coming out as bisexual and what it means to help alleviate the visibility of the bi community, who are often left behind. We continue our conversation with Misty tonight as we explore thinking outside the binary and intersectionality. Misty is doing a PhD study on living outside the binary in Australia, fence sitter or bridge builder, and has received a strong response from Australia's bi community. Dean Arcuri and Misty discuss why and how this came about as we not only look at intersectionality, but the definition itself.
I'm doing research through the Centre for Human Rights Education at Curtin University. It's my PhD. And what I'm looking at is trying to understand the experiences of social recognition of people who are non-binary, either in sexuality or gender or both. And the way I'm doing that, so I've gathered a bunch of demographic data. So 800 people have responded to a basic demographic survey, which I think by itself is actually going to create a really good awareness piece around, you know, this is what the non-binary and bisexual community looks like in Australia, to say, you know, this is the age groups and the ethnicity and, you know, perhaps the education level. So I have all of that data now. And I'm also doing interviews with people who are non-binary and or bisexual across Australia. And those interviews are really just digging into how have they experienced recognition, what does discrimination look like for them, but also what are the wonderful experiences that they've had, why do they love being who they are. So I'm gathering that information now, and I think one of the most interesting things that I've noted so far is that intersection between bisexuality and non-binary genders. There's a very high overlap. So of the 800 people that have answered the survey, 80% of those actually identify as both bisexual and non-binary. So I guess, you know, without having done any of the in-depth research around that, it kind of suggests that thinking outside of the binary kind of happens in terms of sexuality and gender. It doesn't just kind of stop at one or the other.
Misty's study is actually a first of its kind, and there is also a really big study being done at La Trobe University on bisexuality and mental health, which is also being done by a PhD student. When we need more data to be able to provide better support for the bisexual community, why isn't it happening?
Nobody's really looking at that intersection. And the reason I wanted to look at that intersection is because of my own experience of being unable to separate those two things. And so I kind of had a hunch that maybe other people were unable to separate those things as well.
The reality is that the bi community need more attention. Bisexual individuals face many forms of marginalisation, discrimination, and face issues that need to be discussed and resolved. But it seems that we can't do that without proper data to point the way. With such a big response to the study, I asked Misty how they found people to be involved.
I did the bulk of my recruitment last year, and it's still, I mean, the survey is still open, and I'm getting some responses through in dribs and drabs now, but I will close it soon. And, I mean, the recruitment I did really predominantly through Facebook. I do have connections in the bi community and the non-binary and trans communities across Australia. So it was really just about reaching out to everyone I could think of and getting them to promote it. And that really worked a treat. But I think it was also in my methodology in terms of the language that I was using. So rather than saying, I want people who identify as this or that, I was saying anyone who is attracted to more than one gender and anyone who doesn't identify as man or woman, some or all of the time, because I wanted to kind of get around. You know, sometimes identity politics is really uncomfortable for people. And there were some people who responded who identified as lesbians who were married to men, for example. If I had said only people who identify as bisexual, then those people wouldn't have responded. So I think it was sort of a combination of those two things, just using social media and really thinking through my methodology.
While this response to their study is fantastic, it does show that there's a greater community of bi people out there that we may not realise, but it doesn't mean that we're meeting the needs of this community and supporting them. But definition is everything. How do you narrow down what or who you want to be when you're wanting to explore the realities of diversity? After all, bisexuality is one word, but it means so many things.
There's a strange balance there, isn't there? Because, you know, bisexual people are invisible in society and in the LGBTI community often. And so to increase visibility, it's much easier for us to use a word that people know what that means, which is why, you know, I think it's important to have bisexual as part of the language that we use all the time. But yeah, I think also being mindful that sometimes people might say that they are gay or lesbian and be bisexual for all intents and purposes, you know. So I think it's just about finding that balance.
That was Misty Farquhar from Perth, who is doing a PhD study on living outside the binary in Australia, fence sitter or bridge builder. If you would like to be a part of the study, you can find a link via our social media on Twitter and Facebook. We'll also have more stories and perspectives from members of the bi community tomorrow night as a part of Bisexual Health Awareness Month.
This is The Informer on Joy 94.9.
That's it for another episode of The Informer, bringing you news and current affairs from Australia's LGBTI communities. A podcast of tonight's Informer will be available to download soon at joy.org.au or on your preferred podcast platform. Don't forget to follow us on social media at The Informer on Joy 94.9 on Facebook or at The Informer Joy on Twitter. If you have a story or tip you'd like to share with us, get in touch at theinformer@joy.org.au. You've been listening to The Informer on Joy 94.9. I'm Dylan Joel.
This is The Informer on Joy 94.9.